Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Yuyun Zhan, host of our monthly podcast Zhonghua Mundus that brings you recent updates about China's economy. As usual, I am with our co-host, our senior fellow Alicia Garcia Herrero. We're also glad to have with us today Fraser Howie, long-term watcher and author of various books on the Chinese financial system. Fraser, welcome to The Sound of Economics.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
Thank you for joining us today. To start, we would like to dive into China's financial system today. Fraser, could you set the scene for us? Because China's financial system is very different from what we see in Europe or in the US. How does China use its financial system to support its development model and broader political goals?
Look, I think that's a great question, and it's important to be reminded of those differences because we're so used to sort of standardization of financial information. Now, you know, you get GDP statistics, you get bank loans or whatever. And so it seems very easy to compare country to country. But it's important when you remember or when you talk about China to understand the history, because that is obviously the father, as it were, of the present. And quite frankly, 30 years ago, China did not have a functioning financial system. Less than 30 years ago, in 1998, China had to completely recapitalize the banks. It was about 50% non-performing loans. And I think that's very important to remember because the Chinese financial system, how it was structured at the turn of the century, how it's developed, is there to service the state-owned enterprise system. And that basically starts with four state-owned banks, which were cleaned up, recapitalized, but four state-owned banks, which have vast amounts of branches across the country, taking in all the deposits of the Chinese population, and then funneling that to state-owned enterprises based on political preference. And so, let's say 30 years ago, there was a stock market, but there wasn't really a bond market to speak of. There literally was. I was working in it at the time. There were literally six bonds in the Chinese bond market at the time. So you've had this, the trunk of this system is to suck up deposits and then distribute that to state-owned enterprises based on need and not based on, you know, economic realities or good ideas or innovation or creditworthiness, etc. And so that is the base for which you're growing. And now, the Chinese financial system today, well, it's much, much, much larger than it was then, is fundamentally very similar in many ways because of the outsized role that the state has, the outsized roles that the state banks have in terms of deposit-taking institutions, the preferential credit that's going towards state-owned enterprises. That's happening at the national level. It's also happening at the local level, where they have been, because of various restrictions and financial restrictions on local governments, they've been very creative at creating structures to raise more funds, to issue bonds, to try and suck up that, to basically get capital to promote, you know, property development, things like that, factories, building roads, business parks, etc. All that growth we saw through the noughts, and then also in the last decade or so, basically sucking in capital just to produce growth and not worried about either paying it back or worried about the economic returns of the project they're focused on, because their focus was growth. Now, that is still a very big part of it. Of course, the market has now expanded to include many more private sector companies, but you still have a scenario where that most private enterprises are still largely starved of cash, and you have the bulk of financing still ultimately coming from the banks. So that is the broad picture we have. There's obviously a lot of nuance or detail we can go into, but that's, I would say, is the broad picture of what the Chinese financial system looks like, which is very different from certainly from the US or even in Europe.
Thank you so much for that introduction. Alicia, would you like to chip in to this question and just give us a bit more sense of the state of China's financial sector today?
Yeah. So I want to start with this French expression that plus ça change. Yeah. So it changes, but it doesn't change. To basically summarize the situation, on the one hand, as Fraser really described very well, this is a massive financial system which was coming from, you know, basically a monobank. I mean, in very few decades, we have probably the largest banking sector in the world in assets. So you would assume it has changed massively because, you know, you come from nothing to... But when you actually look at the functioning of this banking sector, that's when you start saying maybe not, you know, it hasn't really changed as much as one would have imagined. So although, you know, we had a lot of liberalization, financial liberalization, interest rate liberalization, you name it, when you actually look at the functioning of this banking sector, it's still highly administered, not even regulated, because it's not a question of regulation. It's highly administered. So you can see that the loan rate hardly moves away from, you know, the PBOC's, the central bank's guidance rate for lending. On top of that, the role of the government, which should have disappeared because you imagine, yeah, that, you know, the government can issue bonds. I don't know, like think about a, you know, Western style banking sector. The direct lending to the government is very small. Well, in China, actually, as of today, it's only increasing and it's the largest recipient of lending by the banks. On top of that, and this is also very different from the rest of the world, Chinese banks actually hold, that is proprietary holdings, and also on behalf of their clients, 2/3 of China's bond market on top of. So in a way, they're central to the financial sector, both because they're very large and because they kind of run as well the bond market. But on top of that, they continue to be both because they lend to the government, but also because the government is their shareholder, as Fraser said, totally government-centric or state-centric or even party-centric, to put it more clearly. So, you know, again, going back to the beginning of my plus à change, it didn't change. That part didn't change. And that has enormous consequences because the banking system, and I finish here, is the arm of the government, is the arm of the state, is the arm of the party, is the kind of really the way in which China conducts its policies, whether it's industrial policy, whether it's monetary policy in a way because of the multiplier, but, you know, kind of administered multiplier, money multiplier, or fiscal policies because they hold the bonds and they give credit to the government. So, you know, in that regard, I think banks are essential, but not so much has actually changed in that regard.
I'm always delighted when someone says that because, of course, you're absolutely right. And I'm thinking, okay, it's not just me because, as you know, Alicia, over those 30 years, the scale of the financial system has expanded so much. You think, how can I say to anybody that there's been all this growth, all this increase in, like, say, we had literally when I worked in CICC at the turn of the century, there were 6 bonds, only 2 of which traded. And I think, how on earth can I meaningfully say that, you know, you're going from 6 bonds to literally thousands of debt instruments, commercial paper, long-term, short-term, a whole host of extra products. And yet fundamentally, the nature of the system hasn't changed. But that is the reality. And of course, it's the reality because, and this has varied over time and it's changed somewhat, but remember in Xi Jinping's China today, even with all these sort of notionally private companies, or indeed at times genuinely private companies, China is still broadly a planned economy because it's certainly not an open market economy, but it's not a planned economy in the sense of, okay, you go and make us 1.5 million Wellington boots and you go and make us, you know, 2 million tables or something. It's not planned in that very classic sort of communist or Soviet style of product planning, but it's still very much managed, planned by the political demands and the political focus of the party, of Xi Jinping. He wants to pick winning sectors. And you can certainly, people would look at China and say, hey, look at all the great things they've done in EVs. And that wouldn't have been able unless there was a lot of effectively cheap credit, etc. And you could say, well, that's sort of partly true. But what you have is sort of islands of success in a sea of waste, because you've had a vast amount of credit being expanded to produce relatively limited products or relatively limited areas. And then we tend to ignore all that waste that's gone along with it. And that waste is best reflected, as Alicia said, you have the world's largest banking system, an economy that is, I think, is it something like $60 or $70 trillion is the banking system size, something like that, where you have an economy which is $18 trillion. And so, again, I would just echo Alicia's point. Here you have the state as regulator, the state as borrower, the state as owner of the banks. Everywhere you look, you see the state. And even if you then start to go down to the local government level, or what they call these, their various local government financing vehicles, which technically are independent, legally independent of the state, the reality is, though, everyone's looking at the state as the backstop. So in that sense, it's a very different system from a Western market, open marketplace, and still very controlled. And that brings with it a whole host of problems when you're trying to open up that market, internationalize, loosen up capital controls, or indeed just trying truly price credit.
Yeah, thanks for very much for bringing up the inefficiencies and ways inherent to the financial system. Alicia, let me come back to you. China's policy has been quite opaque, and of course in the financial sectors, and you have said much has changed, but not changed so much. Do you think with China's current economy, is this model still working, or should there be need to change in some ways?
The financial sector needs to change because it reduces the efficiency of the Chinese economy because it doesn't intermediate these huge savings properly. But at the same time, it serves the purpose of China's economic model. So, you know, on the one hand, you would say, why not change it? It's so obvious, yeah? You would increase the efficiency of capital allocation. We all know this. Then why not? Because it serves a purpose, a very specific purpose. So if I want to develop sector A, I don't know, space industry, you know, I cannot do that only out of subsidies because China's fiscal base is very small, actually shrinking. So you cannot only use subsidies, direct subsidies, you know, and this is why we cannot measure really the size of China's industrial policy, because it's not only direct subsidies. There you have what, 60 trillion at your mercy, you know, to basically go beyond direct subsidies. Now, of course, banks do not only, say, give direct lending to local governments, which then they give subsidies. It's more sophisticated. We have, obviously, a lot of state-owned enterprises or even private enterprises that have been signaled through different means. We had once a podcast all on this industrial policy, the 10,000 little giants, you name it, yeah? All of these companies that are signaled, those are favored by these banks, which know very well what they need to do. So that's a non-market signaling, making these banks and their huge assets, which, by the way, are fed by excess savings. Yeah, this is excess savings from households, intermediated by banks that are told what to do, to put it bluntly. And that gives China a lever on industrial policy, on, as Fraser said, on its planning that very few countries have, because you don't have that control of the banking sector. So I think it is therefore important for China to keep a, sorry to say, not so efficient banking sector, because it serves a different purpose. And that's why I think we need to understand that this is not only about efficiency. It's never been in China. But the banking sector is kind of the proof of the pudding that it is not, because that's the main intermediary for this economic model.
That's completely true. I think one thing to note, just in that sort of 25, 30-year journey of the commercialization of certainly the big four banks and the model, you know, there have been, I don't know if there are periods of hope, as it were, but things have perhaps not always been so bleak. There was certainly a time because, again, you had certainly of the big four banks, they were told, hey, we've recapitalized, you now go out, we're going to do IPOs. This was, you know, back 20 years ago. And they wanted to get paid back. They didn't just want to lend out money and be just a dispenser to state-owned enterprises. And so there were many sort of bank bosses who tried to make a go of it, if you like. And there were periods when banks were to be more commercial, but ultimately that ebbs and fades. And this is where the politics has always been so dominant that, particularly under Xi Jinping, who has brought more power to the center, has reaffirmed the primacy of the party, his goals. Then that's that model, that the hope of a more commercialized banking system and a greater focus on generally distribution of risk through a financial system, i.e. that you had independent or private investors taking on disclosure, valuing companies, valuing bonds, and then taking that risk on. That hasn't really happened. Yes, there have been some defaults. Yes, people have certainly lost money. And so it's happened at the edges. But fundamentally, Xi Jinping's has the banking system that he wants to deliver his political goals. And I think it's interesting. I was at an event just yesterday. One of the points I made was that this, you still read it in some, FT, for instance, some economist is writing about how if only China can rebalance between investment and consumption, then China will be able to kickstart its growth model again and everyone will benefit. But again, the reason consumption is depressed in China is exactly so the government can funnel those savings towards what it wants to focus on. And so this is the banking system that the party wants. It is most certainly not an efficient banking system, but that's not what the party is worried about. The party is worried about maintaining control and achieving its goals to deliver what it believes is a strong state and sort of global champions. And so you have this, you have very much an inefficient, suboptimal banking system from an economic standpoint or financial standpoint, but one that perfectly suits the political goals of the party.
And like you said, the more goal is to maintain stability politically over maybe growth or like efficiency of the banking system. But my question is that then in that way, can China just stimulus its way out?
That's exactly what happened. That is 2008, yeah? That's when these balance sheets, bank balance sheets explode literally with the growth rates. Asset growth was around 30% in those years, 2009, 2010. And that is what propelled China's huge nominal growth then, and China's big jump towards the second largest economy in the world. That was the way. But for how many times can you use the banks to do that? Because, once you do that, the banks, especially if they don't lend properly, become undercapitalized because you don't have the capital. So, you have to. And by the way, Fraser mentioned these golden years of, yes, we can do it, we can modernize, which was the beginning of the 2000s when, the foreign banks entered through, ad hoc kind of strategic investors before the IPOs were conducted. But by 2008, many had even left and especially after 2008, because the balance sheet was growing so fast that you had to put so much capital. I mean, I used to work for a bank that left China partially because of this, because you had to put more and more capital. You didn't know where the money was going. It was not very profitable. So, these foreign waves of foreign investors wave left. So now you just have basically, to a large extent, there's of course some float. So basically private investors, but mostly you have public capital. Yeah, public. So you need to put more money in these banks to let them grow continuously, to your point of stimulating the economy through the banking sector. And, everybody knows that they're profitability is waning, and it is not easy to do that again and again, also because there is no private demand for loans. Yeah, housing, no way, I don't want a mortgage, thank you. Consumer loans, sorry, I don't want to consume. Consumer durables is really underwhelming in China. Companies, we have overcapacity, so only the government borrows. So it's not easy to do what China did in 2008 today, even if you control the banks. Because that the more you increase the balance sheet, the more like inefficient lending you have, the more your return on assets goes down. So it's not that they can't, is that what for? That's the question. What for? Should we do this again? Pointless. And that is why China, no matter what investors thought they would do, has really never conducted another big stimulus like 2008 again.
Even the 2024 one is not as big, right?
No. Absolutely no. Much smaller.
No, and of course, to that point, once you've built, a bridge or two bridges or three bridges, you know, you're getting no extra return by building the fourth, the fifth, or sixth. Or again, you can build more blocks of flats, but there are more empty, was it something 60 million empty flats or something? You never know quite what the numbers are. But whatever it is, China most certainly doesn't need more housing. It's got plenty of housing. It's got, you know, there is no amount, there is so much infrastructure that has been built, so much stuff that has simply been made through these stimuluses. You're simply not getting any economic return. And this is where it's important to remember that if there are really such things as laws of economics, China is subject to them as much as any other country. And ultimately, whatever way you set up your banking system, plans, open market, whatever, that the way that you grow an economy is by creating productive assets. And the tragedy is that so much of that bank lending has gone into building effectively non-productive assets. So this is really a burden on, you know, many local governments. You know, you have house blocks that aren't finished or that are finished, but, you know, no one's in them. They haven't been sold or they need to be maintained still or whatever it may be. And so you have this, China has ultimately wasted a lot of money. And that's why I think I said that, and for some things, if you talk about EVs or solar cells, sure, China makes them and they're very cheap and whatever. That's because that's been a state priority. But these are islands of success in this vast sea of wealth. Also, what we haven't really talked about yet is one of the things that's particular to the Chinese system. And although I did accept there had been some bankruptcies and write-downs and some very big ones. If you look at Evergrande or whatever, $300 billion in debt, etc. But so much of one of the big problems as well of this system is that the government is very unwilling to really, you know, write down losses and make, you know, and people accept the losses, accept the bad mistakes, and start again. And so what you find is that you have a lot of companies or banks holding assets, which are still being valued at face value, perhaps, but frankly are worthless. That they'll never return, the project will never repay the debt, etc. And so you have a lot of zombie companies or zombie assets floating around this system. And then because it's now so large, it makes it all the harder to perform that sort of hard surgery. You know, when China, back in the late 90s, when China recapitalized its banks and had 50% non-performing loans, you know, I doubt there were many Western economists who could even have named a Chinese bank. Outside of Bank of China or People's Bank of China, they would have had no idea how the system worked, or they would have no idea about banks. And so therefore, you have this very sclerotic system, vast amounts of debt, most of it non-performing to some extent. And certainly, if it could pay its interest, it almost certainly can't pay its principal back. So you just need to keep rolling over a lot of this debt and hope that there isn't a shock to the system, which could actually undermine the whole edifice.
Thanks very much for that. Going to my next question is that China wants its economy and yuan, its currency, to play a much bigger global role. And we also discussed this, at least if you remember the internationalization push of the yuan in a previous episode. So my question here is China's financial system institutionally and politically ready to internationalize alongside this ambition? Maybe I'll start with you, Alicia.
Okay, it's a good question. I think China wants to internationalize, and it has already massively on the real economy, manufacturing, everything else. China would also, on paper, like to have an international currency. But China is not ready to pay the price to have an international currency. That's the way I would put it. So it sounds, you know, that in order to be the hegemon, and I think it's all, I mean, what are the three things you need? You need an army, you need a strong economy, and you need a reserve currency. So China feels like, okay, what about this third? Where are we with this third? And obviously, it's the most underwhelming. But they also realize that the success of their model relies on these trapped savings. Huge savings, yeah, that those banks can intermediate and la, la, la. If those trap savings suddenly can go, which is a requirement, at least on the textbook, for reserve currency, i.e. capital account convertibility, i.e. open capital account, then what? Can we do it? Will the savings leave? Yeah. And on top of that, as we all know, to have a reserve currency, you better borrow, because the whole point is people hold your currency for a reason. Yeah. But China supposedly is the net creditor. So, you know, this is Japan in the 80s. The yen did some strides, but it was very hard for the yen because others had to borrow in yen. I still remember these samurai bonds in Latin America. Why? Because Japan didn't need to borrow at the time. Now it does borrow massively, but domestically, still domestically, mostly. You know what I mean? Like, China is kind of not in the right place, both because of its capital controls and also because it doesn't borrow internationally enough to have demand for its currency. So China is trying a different way. Trade settlements. I mean, things that relate to its strength, which is the real economy, manufacturing. But can you reach the level of a reserve currency with trade? If we know, I mean, Fraser is the expert here, that financial transactions are multiples and multiples of real transactions, you know? So it's very hard. It's like, reminds me of Don Quixote, you know? Go and fight, but, you know, sorry, these windmills are too high for me. You cannot fight with trade settlements to create a reserve currency, because it's just not enough. So, you know, what China is trying to do is simply impossible. And therefore, it's this, you know, I want it, but I do not want it kind of thing. Or I only want it under certain conditions. Yeah, I don't open the capital account. And my take is, good luck then, because you'll never be a real investment, if you want, reserve currency without that. So that's why I believe that, you know, it's unless we move to a world, and I finish here, where even the U.S. has capital controls, then they will make it very easy because we won't have a pure reserve currency. But I hope we're far from that. But anyway, that's my take.
I wholly agree. It's, as I said, that Xi Jinping doesn't want a strong consumer base. He wants this imbalance and these captive savings to drive his planned economy thinking. And so therefore that, you know, that's the doubling down on exports on made in China 2025, the $1.2 trillion trade surplus. And again, he does that for political reasons. And in the same way, that's, Alicia is absolutely right, that it's the politics as much as anything that drives the non-opening of the capital account. Remember, this is something that's in the reason that China's currency is still relatively underused given the size of its economy is solely because the Chinese have made it so. You know, it's not that there has been nothing to, we've not, the Western world and America hasn't ganged up to stop people from using their RMB. No, it's the Chinese have made it hard to do so that they can continue control the domestic economy by keeping these capital controls in place. And I think from a tie-in to a sort of political economic view, I can't imagine, I don't need to imagine, I don't think there's any case in history where you've had a one-party state who's either freed its currency or has tried to operate its economy with an open currency, because it just doesn't work. Money will flee the country. Now, it's not every renminbi will run out the country, but certainly people will diversify their holdings just to get better returns elsewhere, or they'll diversify, they'll send money out the country to ensure better legal title. There's a whole host of reasons why money would look to get out of China. And so from that standpoint, you're certainly not going to get open convertibility in the way that we currently have the dollar. And even if they opened it up in the way of the dollar, that they don't immediately become a reserve currency, but at least on the path to doing so. It's interesting as well. These questions, of course, are not new. I remember it was in 2010 that China made sort of the really first major step of opening up its currency, starting in Hong Kong, allowing people to hold renminbi accounts overseas. And that was, and then within about 3 years or something, it was something like a trillion renminbi was held in Hong Kong. And then various, you know, investment programs, various other programs as well, and stock and in QFI and various things really expanded to allow money to go into China and also to come out. But it was interesting then. I remember doing talks and various things, and I had a question up, A, B, C, D. A, will China's currency be convertible? It was 0 to 5 years, 5 to 10 years, over 10 years, or never. And I think I was generally the only person in the audience who said never, because people were so optimistic. Hey, it's all happening. It's all coming. But you cannot distinguish the economics from the politics. And control of the currency is hugely important for China to ensure that basically, you know, the money stays where it is. Even if it's inefficiently used, even if there's a tremendous amount of waste, with an open capital account in the, as per the dollar, then the politics is turned on its head.
Thanks very much, Fraser. That's a very good concluding thought from you and for what the listeners can take away. Alicia, would you like to add a final comment to the episode?
My final comment is that it's such a pleasure to listen to Fraser, because this is kind of, yes, I agree. Yes, I agree. I also agree. I feel like poor listeners because we agree too much, but it's not always the case, Fraser. But even if we agree, the key message here is that the kind of the image out there is actually quite different. So yes, we agree, but you know, it's not everybody agrees. And I really think that there's this very different view of this financial sector as if it had been fully reformed, fully in place, fully liberalized, because you see these names, as Fraser said. Now everybody sees these names everywhere. But when you scratch the surface, as Fraser did for us today, it's quite different. And I think that's a good, an important takeaway for our listeners.
Thank you very much both for joining this episode. This is The Sound of Economics. I am with Alicia Garcia-Herrero and Fraser Howie. You can find all our past episodes on Brugo's website. And until next time, bye-bye.